Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Topp. I lost 135 pounds and drastically improved my whole family's health adopting a paleo lifestyle. My husband Matt, who happens to be the producer of this podcast, and I blog our recipes, successes, and struggles at paleoparents.com. Matt and I have authored two cookbooks, Eat Like a Dinosaur, a family-friendly recipe and guidebook for kids, and the upcoming Beyond Bacon, which is a paleo recipe book respecting the whole hog, nose to tail, due out in hardback July 2nd, 2013. We have a passion for family-friendly meals that are practical, affordable, and sustainable to the earth, as well as our long-term health.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne. I was a scientist before becoming a full-time stay-at-home mom and the blogger behind thepaleomom.com. I'm also the author of the upcoming book, The Paleo Approach, available for pre-order now off Amazon and due out September 28th, 2013. Both my blog and The Paleo Approach are heavily focused on the autoimmune protocol. I also blog about the practical application of the paleo diet and share wonderful recipes.
Next up, News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip.
Howdy.
Hi.
How's it going?
Oh, all right. I CrossFitted today.
So you're tired?
Yeah. I didn't CrossFit for the, 2 weeks as we were finishing the book. And we went back Saturday, and I, couldn't finish a WOD, which is not surprising because I was still, recovering.
In burnout mode, yeah.
Yeah, recovering from getting 3 hours of sleep a night for many nights. And so I had a good long weekend and relaxed, and I was like, all right, I'm going to crush it today. And I did not crush it. I mean, I finished. And then I almost vomited.
That is not cool.
I know. But I didn't. And, yeah. So, it was fun, but it's also a reminder that you can't just heal yourself in one weekend from, taxing your body and being stressed out and all the things that we talk about all the time.
You can heal quickly, but one weekend is still pushing it.
So, anyway.
So, besides CrossFit, how was Mother's Day?
Mother's Day was really nice. It was really beautiful weather here.
It was here, too.
And the boys took good care of me. We made the Urban Posers Samoa donuts.
I saw that on Facebook, and I'm drooling just thinking of the pictures.
They tasted as good as Jenny made them look, which I didn't think was actually possible. But we bought a donut machine as part of my Mother's Day present for this endeavor, because that's what Jenny said you have to do, and I was going to do whatever Jenny says because she's the donut expert in my mind. And so we made them, and they're these tiny mini donuts. Maybe three of them would equal one regular size donut,
Yeah.
And I had 2.5, not together. I wasn't shoveling them all in my mouth at one time, but I had 2.5, and I hit a wall, and I was like, whoa, I'm done. And it was really awesome because we haven't been eating a lot of really super sweet treats lately. I know that people might not believe that because we run a blog and we put treats on there, but oftentimes we, give them away or we have parties or whatever. And even when we are making them, we've been using less and less sweetener in our own home and using fruits as sweeteners just because, it's healthier. And our taste buds are adapting to not need that sweetness. So it was really refreshing to kind of eat what would have been less than one serving in my previous livelihood. I mean, I could have probably eaten the whole batch pre-paleo and probably last year eaten, 5 or 6 or whatever. But at 2.5, I was like, well, I'm done. That's all I needed. I didn't have any more all day. They're sitting around upstairs. I didn't have any today. They're not even tempting me. They're delicious. But I feel like I had them. They were amazing. And now I'm done with them.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah. I feel really good about that.
I don't think I'm in that place right now.
Sorry.
I won't test it. I won't test it, but I have a suspicion. I'm at that, you know, just enough cortisol to be like craving energy dense foods.
Yeah.
And it sort of changes between craving fat and craving sugar. And I try as much as I can to pick like really nutritious and pick fat sources rather than sugar sources, because sugar sources can sort of lead to that vicious cycle. Whereas fat sources tend not to. I mean, it's still way too many calories for me, but that's a whole, I'm not worrying about that right now. But yeah, I have to say though, I have felt so much better the last few days. I am really close, like probably an hour's worth of work close from being done part two of the book.
Woo!
And the chapter 9, which is the troubleshooting chapter, which was sort of the last chapter in the book that had a fair amount of science in it, because that's what troubleshooting is. It was miserable to write. It really was a lot of topics that are, you know, not my area of expertise. And also there's a lot of pressure not to get anything wrong. So it really required a lot of research and so I was just so happy when I finished that. And then chapter 10 has been a fairly straightforward chapter. I'd already written half of it, so it's starting to come together really well. And I think an hour's worth of work will do it. And then I just have the cookbook part of this beast to finish. And I'm really looking forward to that shifting gears. Like I have learned so much writing this book. That's going to be enormous. We are trying to find a balance in the formatting so that it's not, you know, 6-point font like a textbook, but that it's a low enough number of pages that we can actually bind it. I had no idea when I started this project that it was going to be such a big book. Like I knew the topic was big, but I didn't really have any kind of understanding of, okay, well, when I explain this and this and this and this and this, it's going to be, it's like 210,000 words right now.
I don't even comprehend how many,
well, like,
how big that is.
Practical Paleo is 90,000 words.
Holy cow.
The whole book.
Including the recipes.
So, this is going to be a very information dense book. I mean, really, had I known, it probably would have been a hardcover book and it probably would have sold for double the price. So people are getting a tremendous deal with this book, because if we had really, like, if I had written half the book before negotiating the book deal and before we'd had it on Amazon, actually, if we'd had a better understanding of what it was going to be, it would have either been two books and been the science book and the cookbook, or it would have been like an $80 hardcover book. So I hope that excites people more than intimidates them. I've really gone to a lot of effort to make the science approachable the same way I do on my blog, which I guess is part of why it's 200,000 words. If I was just going to write it technically for doctors, it would probably be a quarter that long. But I'm hoping that balance of, you know, it's definitely a complete guide. And I'm hoping that I've got a good balance between science and practical, like part two. Granted, there's some science in part two, but it's really like the practical implementation, what to eat, you know, what lifestyle factors to focus on, and some, you know, tricks for managing stress and, you know, ways to improve your sleep and things like that. So I've tried to do the science and the whys and also the practical, and then also like a whole cookbook. So it's a beast. I think it's being nicknamed the encyclopedia. I just kind of feel like, I still feel like I can't take a break. I mean, I did actually take half the day off yesterday, but but I feel like I'm like racing for the finish line. But at the same time, I feel like I'm going to actually make it to the finish line. So I feel I'm in a better headspace. I'm still tired. I still feel the effects of cortisol in my body. I'm still looking forward to, I'm going to have at least 3 days off between when I turn in the complete book and when I start getting edits back. Woohoo! 3 days. I'm going to sleep the whole day, all three of those days, I plan. But I did take some time off yesterday and spent some time in the yard with the kids. We ended up just hanging around the house. We had all these when I decided I was going to take part of the day off, we had all these grand plans of we're going to go for a hike and we're going to go to a playground and we're going to do all these great things. And then we ended up like not leaving the house and just hanging out in our pajamas until like 11 in the morning. And then playing, because it was such a beautiful day, playing in the backyard. And I cleaned up all the flower pots, which was kind of a nice, you know, get my hands in the dirt. And then the flower pots look all nice again. So, yeah, it was kind of a nice day.
Cool. So I think we should also mention, since we're talking about Mother's Day, that the special bonus episode we've been talking and teasing about actually went live yesterday on Mother's Day, which will be many days ago by the time people hear this podcast.
But it's still up.
Yeah. No. It'll be up for a long time.
If people hear about this in a week, that doesn't mean that they can't get it anymore.
Or months. Or whatever. Months. It'll still be there.
Years. I don't know if yours, but yeah.
I don't know. But yes. So, just so everybody knows from the technical side, by the time this goes live, it should be available in iTunes. However, you have to look for it under a song instead of a podcast because, Sarah and I had long discussions about how we were going to try to, recoup some of the costs associated with the podcast, both actual costs from hosting and the technical equipment that we've bought and all of that kind of stuff, as well as the time costs that go into, you know, Matt producing the show and Sarah researching the science segment of the show. And we've actually hired, as we mentioned before, Monica, who's doing the show notes for us in an attempt for us to kind of save our health. So we want to continue to do this podcast. We have absolutely no intention of stopping this podcast or charging for this podcast. And as long as, you know, we continue to do it, it should be free. We have absolutely no intention of changing that. However, we were hopeful that since a lot of people say that they like this part of the show, the gossipy, chatty, how's it going, tell us about your real life, part of the show, that we wanted to devote more time to that in a slightly structured environment, so that Sarah and I could kind of have a personal, intimate experience with the people who want to have it. And for that, we've asked that people pay a small nominal fee of 99 cents to download that episode. And, you know, we don't even get half of that if you purchase it through iTunes. So we're not trying to be crazy, you know, steal all your money people. It's just that it literally has cost us quite a bit of money to produce the show. And we love putting out the free content. We love supporting everyone, but we just are hopeful that we can have a mutually beneficial relationship so that if you're a listener and you like listening and you want to support us, then by all means, please go download the show. It will help us out a lot. If you don't, then don't worry about it. You're not missing anything. That's, you know, that's a separate offline thing. And yeah. So with that said, did you have a chance to listen to it? Because I was the one that QA'd it, and you—I don't think you
listened
to it.
To
you
it
still
yet.
Haven't.
No.
Are you intentionally not going to listen to it?
No. I think I am. I am interested in listening to it because it's always, there's always this surreal part of like listening to what I say. And then I have this like super critical part of me that sometimes will listen to what I say. I'll be like, wow, Sarah, that was like not the right words for that. Or sometimes I'll listen to myself and be like, yeah, you nailed that. That was awesome. And this is such a different format because it's just so personal. And, I am kind of interested in going back and listening to that conversation again. But no, I seriously, every spare second has been on the book. So, I should download it so that I can listen to it next time I'm cooking. Hmm. That would be perfect. Well, that's mostly when I listen to podcasts, because I'm not even in the car by myself very often, because I have a 3.5-year-old who's in tow all the time.
Oh, my boys love to listen to the podcast, and we listen to this one in the car, and because our mothers are on it, they recognized my mom, their grandmother, and they were like, is that Gigi? Is she on the phone? Can we talk to Gigi? And I was like, no, Gigi's not on the phone. Gigi's talking about how crazy mommy was. So just be quiet.
Yeah, that might confuse my kids too, because it's, I have a Bluetooth in my car. So it's one of the things that we sometimes do for driving like 20 minutes from point A to point B is like, hey, let's talk with Nana.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what they thought too. Yeah. So, yeah, well, I listened to it and, it was a little like, whoa, we really did talk about that. My mom really did just say that to everyone. There were a couple of points where both your mom and my mom kind of unleashed floodgates about our past and what brought us to where we are today and kind of how they saw the struggles that they had as mothers trying to raise girls who had body image issues or, you know, in my case, eating disorders or whatever it was. So I feel like if you are a mother or if you are a daughter, that show will ring true to a lot of people, just because I think it was a lot about, as I listen back to it, relationships and how to have healthy, good relationships. And I know a lot of the listeners find a lot of commonalities between our stories and their personal lives. And if that's the case for you, this show might be worth listening to, just because we get into a lot of those details. It's 90 minutes of our moms giving the scoop.
Our moms telling embarrassing stories about us.
All right. So that said, also I'm at a standing desk. I converted my regular desk to a standing desk because my treadmill desk broke. This is the problem with Craigslist. Yeah. I don't know if the person that sold it to me like knew it was broken and had temporarily rigged it to, like... Because she told me, like, only go up to 3 miles an hour on it. Don't do blah, blah. I told you it was, like, a tank from 1984.
Yeah.
So we didn't go over 3 miles an hour on it, but eventually it's, like, going off the track. So if somebody listening has some sort of, like, contact to a treadmill fixer person, let me know. But we've tried everything to get it to, like, get back on track, and each time it, like, keeps skewing to the side. So I might have to bite the bullet and get, like, a nice new one, but in the meantime, while I save my monies and cross my fingers that maybe Matt can fix the one that we've got, I have converted my regular desk to a standing desk, which means I am never sitting anymore. Because I have like a big computer that I do like my photos and stuff on, and then I have my laptop that I was using on the treadmill desk for like emails and blogging and simple things like that. And so now, no matter what I'm doing, I'm standing, which is interesting. And this is my first podcast standing. So hopefully.
Yeah, I've been standing and walking all day. So I'm sitting now. I actually spend, depending on what I'm doing, I spend a fair amount of time at my treadmill desk, but with the treadmill off and just standing at the desk and working. It kind of depends. Like if I'm reading a paper, the print is so small, I get motion sick if I'm actually trying to do that while walking. So there's certain things that I like to do, and I don't like to walk right after meals. I find that if I get up and get walking too soon after I eat breakfast or eat lunch or something, then I don't feel very well. So so I do spend a fair amount of time just standing at my desk as well. And I like being able to pick one or the other. I definitely feel a lot better spending so much less time sitting during the day than I used to. It's awesome.
Yeah. I like it so much. I'm considering embarrassing myself in the office and making an optional stand-up thing. you know.
You spend so much time at work. Like, that's a way bigger chunk of your time than you're spending.
I know, but it's also, like, you know, a thing to be the weird one at work. Like, I'm already the weird one at work. I don't know that a stand-up desk could really give them a different opinion than they already have.
Well, as long as you're saving the amber-tinted glasses for at home, I think you're good.
The other thing, too, is I'm like, what would I do? Because would I take off my heels? You know, like, I don't always wear flats to work. And I don't want to be standing all day in, like, wedges or heels. So then I'm like the weird person who takes off her shoes and stands at her desk.
True. I mostly go barefoot. Although I did buy myself a pair of five-finger Vibrams for when I know I'm going to have, like, 2 or 3 hours of straight, then I find that having some footwear is nice. Otherwise, the bottom of my feet get really hot on the bottom of the treadmill. But
if these are our biggest problems, I don't think we really have problems.
No, paleo problems, totally.
Oh, have you seen that new site? Oh, shoot. What is it called? The Tumblr site? I'm going to tell you exactly what it's called right now because everybody needs to go check it out.
All right, tell me. I'm ready.
I'm going to hit you with it in just a minute. Hold on. I have to look it up. Are you getting ready? You ready?
I am. I'm ready.
What should we call paleolife.tumblr.com? Have you seen this?
No.
What should we call paleolife.tumblr.com is a site where someone has gone through and found really funny GIFs and then, like, made them into paleoisms. So there's one where, like, a guy and a cat are staring into each other's eyes and it's doing, like, that warpy Star Trek thing. And it's like, when I realized that feeding my cat raw food was totally paleo, let's see, what else does it have? This is probably really obnoxious and boring to people. It doesn't really do you any good if you're not seeing the GIFs. But, like, there's one of a dog eating peanut butter. You know how, like, the tongue goes out for 10 times after they eat peanut butter?
Yeah.
It's like me after I make almond butter.
Oh, I see it. That's hysterical.
Yeah, the site's just hysterical. So if you're looking for a laugh, this site is entirely, like, hashtag paleo problems.
This is probably totally draining my
Oh, yeah, we should both get off
while
this.
We're
We should get off that site while we're podcasting.
I'm just watching, like, how the, like, videos are, like, going ka-chug, ka-chug, ka-chug. And I'm like, oh, I hope this is keeping Skype working.
All right. So anyway, there we have it. Treadmill All desk right. broken, stand-up desk in place. Visit that website. It'll make you laugh. Mother's Day show available for download. High five props if you download it. Please also don't forget to leave your iTunes reviews both on this show and on the one you download if you download it. Happy Mother's Day to everyone, which we forgot to say last week.
It's true. Happy Mother's Day.
Happy belated Mother's Day to all of you. And to our 9 male listeners. No, I think we're up to 13. I hope you treated the ladies in your life.
I have one Facebook fan who actually spent the last month catching up on all 38 episodes.
That's hardcore.
And what was cool was he kept, like, asking me questions. It was awesome. Shout out. Hola. But I was like, dude, that's what I did when I first started podcasts. I did that with, like, Rob Wolf's podcast. I got up to, like,
totally
episode 70 in, like, a month. And then I totally lost my steam because I got really busy. But yeah, I think that's just so, so cool that people are doing that with our podcast.
Well, welcome, newcomers.
Yeah. All, I don't know how many men now. I think we're up to, like, easily 15 or 16.
Maybe we should do a show.
Eventually.
You have anything else you want to talk about?
Science? Probably. Science, yeah. Sure.
What's our show about anyway? What are we doing today?
We're doing a really technical sciencey show, actually.
You'd never know it from this chatter.
That's true. So to switch gears completely, we're actually doing a show about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and H. pylori and gut repair. Like some in-depth stuff today.
I don't know that people can find us credible after the last 15, 20 minutes that we've just been chattering, but
we can try.
We'll do our best. We promise there's some substance behind these.
We can switch gears. I promise.
Cool. Why don't you dig out that science then?
All right.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys. So today, Science with Sarah is actually sort of inspired by a question that you had, Stacey, last week, which was, why do people react more violently to a food after eliminating it? And then the sort of follow-up of, you know, when you stop reacting to a food, is that a really good indicator that your gut has healed? So to just talk a little bit about food allergies and intolerances. And this type of reaction really stems from antibody production in response to a food. So what happens in even a healthy gut, there are cells that line the gut whose job it is to sort of sample the environment inside the gut. They take little bits of whatever's there, food, the normal bacteria that live in your gut, any invasive, you know, pathogens that might be there, any toxins that might be there, and they present that to the immune system, and it's part of the body's sort of normal patrol system, like just constantly checking out what's going on inside the gut, so we know if we need to, you know, get all excited and mount an immune system response to some invader. If you have a leaky gut, of course, you know, a lot more of what's inside the gut can leak into the body and then be presented to the immune system and potentially activate the immune system. So food intolerances are certain types of antibodies. Food allergies are another type of antibody. And that's really the only difference is what type of antibody is being produced. So food allergies are IgE antibodies, and food intolerances are IgA, IgG, IgM, and potentially IgD, although that hasn't really been studied in the scientific literature. So the cells that produce these antibodies are cells of one arm of the immune system. It's called the adaptive immune system, and it's the immune system, part of the immune system that's responsible for fighting something specific. It's the part of the immune system that's responsible for developing immunity to things. I mean, that's the part of the immune system that is responsible for making sure that we don't get the exact same, you know, flu bug twice, that every time we get the flu, it's actually a slightly different bug. It's the one that makes sure we develop immunity after a vaccine. So there are, you know, quite a number of different cell types that are part of this part of the immune system. And there are some that are part of, you know, ramping up this immune response and attacking this foreign invader. There's also cells whose job it is to keep everybody calm. So if you think of some of these cells as being little soldiers, they're kind of like middle management too. They're sort of the cells that kind of direct everything else. And then there's the cells that are just like the therapists who just say, okay, like, let's relax. And their job is actually to suppress the immune system so it doesn't get out of control. And when you get to the end of an infection, it's these cells that dominate. They divide and they grow in numbers, and eventually they can just completely quench the entire immune response. So it's their job to make sure that the immune system doesn't get out of control, that it doesn't attack the wrong things, and that the immune system deactivates once the threat is gone. So in a food intolerance or a food allergy, you get these activated cells that the sort of middle management cells that direct other cells to produce antibodies. And in a normal person, what would happen is if you were producing antibodies to a food, you would have something called immune tolerance. This means that you would have these suppressing cells working to completely all the time suppress these middle management cells that want to make a reaction. So you would have an equilibrium between the cells that are trying to react and the cells that are suppressing everything, and you would end up with no symptoms. When you have a food allergy or food intolerance, that system's out of balance. So you've either got a lot of these cells that can get all agitated that they have found something that you're sensitive to, and or you could have a decrease in the number of cells that are supposed to keep everybody calm, or you can have both, and you can have a really, really skewed system. So it happens when we start an elimination diet, and that's kind of any elimination diet, whether you're just gluten-free or you've responded to a food allergy test or food sensitivity test and cut some foods out, or you're doing a paleo diet, which is a type of elimination diet. What happens, what can happen anyways, and it's certainly there's a genetic factor, so there's some variability here, but what can happen is that the number of cells whose job it is to suppress everything goes down faster than the number of cells whose job it is to remember things that we're supposed to be protecting against and recognize those things and then get all agitated when it sees them. Those cells that recognize an allergen in a food, are their numbers go down more slowly. And you hit this point when your body is healing and your gut is healing where the number of cells that are getting agitated because they can detect a food allergen are higher than the number of cells that can suppress them. And that's one of the ways that we get these really exaggerated responses. Say, before you went paleo, you ate bread and you know, maybe didn't feel great. You had a few sort of minor health issues, but you never had really bad reactions to bread. Now that you've been paleo for 6 months, if you have, you know, even a teaspoonful of something that might have gluten in it, you get super, super violently ill. This is one of the ways that process happens. There's some other mechanisms that can go on here, and I've talked about some of those before, things like the mucus lining of the gut thinning because it's no longer protecting yourself from foods that you're sensitive to. That means basically that when you do have that food, more of it can cross the gut and interact with the immune system, which means then that's another way that you can have this exaggerated response. The more you eat, the more this response, it scales directly with how much of this particular food that you're sensitive to that you eat. As your gut continues to heal, as your immune system regulates, because when you follow a paleo diet, you're eating all this great micronutrient-rich foods and you're providing your body with all of the nutrition that it needs to regulate hormones, to regulate the immune system, to heal the body. As your body continues to heal, eventually you will end up at a point where the, you know, cells that get all agitated when they detect something are also low. So, you know, both of these types of cells that are responding to food are at low levels. And that's when you start to get to a point where if you do get exposed to something, your reactions stop being so exaggerated. So it's a very, very good indicator that your gut has healed and that your immune system is really, really well regulated. When you get to that point where, you know, perhaps you don't want to eat a slice of bread, but eating something that was cut on a, you know, board that a, you know, piece of bread was cut on and it was just wiped with a paper towel and not thoroughly washed, and that causes a reaction. I mean, that's a really good place to be, where sort of that those accidental exposures don't cause dramatic reactions. How long that takes to get there is dependent on a huge variety of factors. It's dependent on your genetics. It's dependent on your stress level, on how well you're sleeping, on how nutrient dense your diet is, on what else might be in your diet that might be suboptimal. It depends on how well your hormones are regulated. It's a whole big complicated system, but there is sort of this point of exaggerated response. And then there is actually this point beyond it. And that's a good thing to think about for anybody who's sort of struggling with these types of exaggerated food reactions sort of early on in their paleo journey.
I think that does get to the topic that I kind of brought up before, which is that you know, when we were on the panel at PaleoFX with Chris Kresser, I think it was the Cave Kids one, he mentioned that, you know, health isn't having a violent reaction after you've been exposed to bad food, that that's part of the process to healing. But health is when you get exposed to that bad food, that your body is able to recover, and that you know the best ways to help your body recover, which we've talked about before. We can put a link in the show notes about our recovery show with Diane Sanfilippo. But ultimately, people should know that although the first couple of months or the first 2 years or however long it takes of having, you know, being on a paleo diet and you get exposed to something and you're in gut-wrenching pain and you have all these problems, that as your gut begins to heal, it's kind of a bell curve effect, and, you know, you're at the worst part of it and then you kind of ride back down. And on the other side of that bell curve, you feel, or you should feel, after an exposure, the same way that you did before you healed your gut, only now you don't have all that chronic inflammation causing you to have asthma, allergies, depression, or whatever it was you had before that your body was chronically sick with as it was trying to deal with that intolerance to the food that made you sick. So that's my, like, layman's approach to all that complicated stuff you just talked about.
I think you summarized well with the bell curve, and I heart Chris Kresser.
I know. And I need to give props to Russ from The Domestic Man, because when he was here for potluck, I think it was 2 weeks ago, he actually brought it up and we had a good discussion about it. And that's what kicked off my suggestion to you that we cover the topic. So props to Russ. I don't know that he listens to the show. If he does, that's 14 men. So cool. I think we have some questions on the topic.
We have some great questions.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So our first question is from Brittany from St. Peter's, Missouri. And Brittany writes, our current functional medicine doctor thinks we all have SIBO, which stands for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and wants us on a FODMAP-free diet. With all our other food issues, I'm concerned that we won't get the nutrition needed and my breast milk supply will suffer along with my children's sleep. What is the difference between FODMAPs and GAPs and SCD? How do I know which to choose? I can't get into a GI doctor for 2 months for the hydrogen breath test. Thank you so much for the service you provide. It has been so valuable on our road to recovery.
Aww.
Yeah. So, I mean, they have a very complicated family history with a lot of food sensitivities, which I didn't read. But I thought maybe we should talk a little bit about these sort of three, and I'd actually throw in the paleo autoimmune protocol as a potential fourth, different but highly related approaches for dealing with bacterial overgrowths.
So you're going to have a lot to say. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to give Stacey, if this person emailed me, I would recommend that they would look into a GAPS diet or a really structured approach to healing their gut. And I can't even imagine how difficult that is with children. I do have experience with limiting our children's food because, as we've talked about before, my middle child and I have very similar genetics, and I found that the foods I'm sensitive to, he's sensitive to. He also has some other sensitivities to things that I evidently outgrew or healed myself out of. So, I know how difficult it is to put kids on something like an autoimmune protocol or something like GAPS. I have seen and heard some amazing success stories from people who take a real serious approach to healing their gut with things like bone broth and organ meats and foods that don't irritate but actually heal the gut. And then, you know, on the other side of that, as difficult as it is, then you won't have these sensitivities, just like we talked about in science. So for me, that's what I would suggest because it kind of encompasses all the things that she's dealing with. It sounds to me like there's a really bad gut imbalance if there's SIBO and there's FODMAPs and some of the stuff that she's mentioning, like you said, maybe autoimmune protocol. So yeah, go for it. I just also want to say one of the things that you didn't mention is that her daughter's drinking camel's milk. And we talked a long time ago on one of our shows about, camel milk being the closest thing to humans and how weird that was. So I just want to, call out Brittany, like, I don't even know where you would find camel's milk, but interesting.
In Missouri.
Evidently in Missouri is where you find it.
So GAPS and SCD are very similar diets in terms of the foods that you avoid and the foods that you eat. The GAPS diet is more of an inclusive system, so SCD is just a diet. GAPS also includes detoxifying mineral salts baths and drinking diluted apple cider vinegar at certain times of day. And I have to admit that, you know, I don't know all of the inner workings of the GAPS diet, but it is sort of more of a system that sort of includes some of these other things. The general concept behind both of these diets is that you starve the bacteria in your gut. So they're very, very low sugar, very, very low starch, especially starch diets. There's some extremely simple sugars that basically monosaccharides. So, you know, one sugar molecules that are allowed on both of these diets. But they are very, very low carbohydrate approaches. I don't know about the SCD diet, but I know that the GAPS diet also has a focus on sort of healing foods. When you first start GAPS, it's a lot of soups and broth. And I know that both of these diets are very compatible with things like digestive enzyme supplements, which I'm going to talk about more in a second. The low FODMAPs diet, what FODMAPs are is basically fermentable sugars, and it is basically sugars and fibers typically that are very, very rich in fructose, but this also includes sugar alcohols and long fiber chains that are rich in fructose. These are sugars that are very, very difficult for our body to digest and to absorb, and they're very, very easily fermentable, which means that they are an excellent food source for whatever lives in our guts. In a normal situation, you know, these are the types of foods that cause flatulence. You know, they're often the foods that are high FODMAP foods are often the foods that we associate as being sort of gassy foods. That's sort of like in a normal person that still happens. In somebody who has a FODMAP sensitivity, this is also sometimes called fructose malabsorption. It means that your body's having an even harder time digesting and absorbing these sugars. So there's even more to feed the bacteria. And if you have a bacteria overgrowth, that can be a real problem. And it can actually, it can lead to bacterial overgrowth. So you can start with a FODMAP sensitivity, more of these fermentable sugars and fibers end up in the large intestine than would normally happen. That feeds all of the bacteria that live in the large intestine, which is actually most of the bacteria in your gut or in the large intestine. But it overfeeds them, and then it sort of allows this sort of migration up the small intestine of bacteria. And sometimes the overgrowth is bacteria that are in the wrong place. Sometimes it's the ones that should be there, but they're just in greater numbers. Sometimes there's a complete skewing of which ones are in which relative quantities to each other. And so there's basically as many different ways of having bacterial overgrowth as there are people who have it. The autoimmune protocol sort of combines, in a sense, some of those things. But the autoimmune protocol more focuses on the inclusion of foods that are known to normalize gut bacteria rather than cutting things out. So two of the foods that are known to have the most profound difference on the composition of your gut are omega-3 fatty acids and fiber. And the composition of your gut flora, which are the bacteria in your gut, can normalize very, very quickly with a high omega-3 diet that includes all of your carbohydrate sources as being fibrous sources, which would basically mean that you're eating fruits and vegetables and not really high, the sort of higher sugar grains and legumes, which of course on a paleo diet we're not doing anyways. The autoimmune protocol can be combined with a low FODMAP approach, although it doesn't have to be. And it can be combined with a low starch approach, although it doesn't have to be. Now, I will say that in spite of a tremendous amount of anecdotal evidence showing that GAPS and SCD diets can be very powerful approaches for bacterial overgrowth, there are no scientific studies to back them up. The low FODMAP diet has a fairly large amount of scientific literature showing that it can be helpful for a variety of gastrointestinal disorders, including bacterial overgrowth, including irritable bowel syndrome, including autoimmune diseases that affect the intestines, such as Crohn's and colitis and even celiac disease. So there is, you know, a large number of people who have experienced success on GAPS and SCD. One of the issues that people face when they adopt a GAPS or SCD diet is that eventually you hit a point where the low carbohydrate intake has starved the overgrowth, but it's also starved the good bacteria. And there's becomes a point where you really need to reintroduce prebiotics, which basically means, you know, fiber that your bacteria can eat. A lot of people focus on soluble fiber as being prebiotic fiber, but insoluble fiber can also be prebiotic. So it basically means eating more vegetables, eating more starchy vegetables, eating some fruit. And there comes a point where you actually need to start introducing those foods in order to feed good bacteria. And that's where it becomes really important to also be having a high omega-3 fatty acid intake and to have a really nutrient-dense diet. So that's where something like the autoimmune protocol can be really, really beneficial, because it is, you know, probably the most nutrient-dense version of a paleo diet or anything that's related out there. So, that's a really long answer for explaining the difference between FODMAPs and GAPS and the specific carbohydrate diet. There's a lot of similarities between them. Because of my science background, if I was starting this process over, because I did have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth when I started, if I was starting this process over again, I would be tackling it combining a standard paleo diet with a low FODMAP diet. That would be my choice, and I would be seeing how that works for me. But that being said, I mean, I don't want to undermine the tremendous amount of success that thousands of people have had with GAPS and SCD. So even though there isn't scientific studies to back that up, there is a very, very large amount of anecdotal evidence. So, Stacey, do you think I answered the question?
I do. I just want to clarify. I think the thing with the GAPS that works so well is, like you mentioned, that it focuses on nutrient density, which is something that sometimes people miss when referring to paleo. Like, we talk about that a lot, and some other paleo people talk about that a lot. But, you know, if you're doing a paleo approach and you're filling your plate with foods that are not the most nutrient dense, like, let's say, lean chicken, and you snack on almonds, and you're eating, you know, the same three vegetables over and over again, you're not going to get the same kind of nutrient density as you would be if you included bone broth and organ meat. And I hate to like keep harping on this because I know that some people just aren't ready and aren't comfortable with it. But the reason that we talk about it, well, for me personally, isn't because it's my favorite thing in the world. Like, I know, Sarah, you like the weird stuff, but you know, I've become,
I like some of it.
I'm like, yeah. I'm going to eat this because it's good for me. And that period, yeah. That's the end of the story, you know? And it's hard to explain, especially when you're early in your paleo journey. Again, there's like this bell curve where when you first start paleo, you don't need to worry about any of that. Just cutting out the junk is going to make you feel so much better. But then when you feel so much better and you take a, you know, overall look at where you are and where you want your health to be, resolving things like gut bacteria imbalances, whatever they may be, are really essential to health, long-term health. You know, Sarah, I think we've talked about before that there is scientific research that shows that cancer is linked to these sort of problems. And mm-hmm. paleo or not, you want to resolve your gut imbalances, and you want a strong, healthy digestive system because that is what makes you healthy long term.
There are some researchers who basically believe that all chronic illness comes back to the health of the gut microflora, that we are not a single organism. We are a collection of organisms that live in a symbiotic relationship with each other. And when we don't have the right balance, that's when we have illness.
So I just want to reiterate, you know, for me, it's not just like, oh, it's cool and fun to say bone broth and organ meat. Like, I have soup every single morning for breakfast because I want to be healthy. The healthiest I can possibly be long term. You know, we talk about it in the bonus podcast, but my mom's adopted. I have absolutely nothing, no knowledge at all what is coming genetically for me. All I know is what I see my mom. Unfortunately, my mom has been, you know, cancer free and she's got celiac and some problems, but she's also got, you know, issues from a lifelong of not knowing that she needed to not be eating gluten. And so I don't know what else there is, but from what I've seen in the research that I've seen, people who go a lifelong of not addressing food intolerances often end up with chronic diseases and health issues. And so for me, it is number one top priority to fill my plate with nutrient-dense foods. And that means that sometimes Matt has to sneak organ meats into my meatballs and my hamburgers because I don't like it. I'm like, you know what? I wrote a nose-to-tail book, and I'll be the first one to tell you, like, I never am going to want to sit down to a plate full of liver and onions. Like, that is I'm never going to be that person. Which is why I have recipes to make them palatable, because I want to eat them for the health purposes. So, you know, when we talk about the GAPS protocol, when we talk about the autoimmune protocol, when we talk about paleo, all of these things, it's essential that you, if you take that approach, no matter what it is, that you're taking the nutrient-dense road and you're focusing on not just what you can't eat, but what you should eat, because I would argue that that is just as helpful, if not more helpful. I know for me personally, I started seeing the best results from going on an autoimmune protocol, not when I stopped eating some of the foods, but when I started getting better sleep, eating bone broth every day, and incorporating organ meats. Those things, then I saw huge results from being on an autoimmune protocol, but I didn't see huge results right away from just eliminating nuts. So if anybody is having any of these problems, I would say, you know, if you have joint pain and you're not ready to go, you know, all the way with whatever it is, fine, but try at least to incorporate some of the healthier, more nutrient-dense foods, which is why I mentioned GAPS, because I know from friends of mine that aren't paleo who have done GAPS, that GAPS does focus on those things, specifically bone broth and foods that are gentle and healing to the gut. And I think that's just really important. And I know we have some literature on it. Practical Paleo has literature on it. The Balanced Bites podcast and website have information on it. Chris Kresser does. But there isn't a huge proponent of the paleo movement that's really focused yet on nutrient density as being just as important as the elimination part. And I just really think it's important that people get that, which is why I mentioned it. Sorry, I'll step off my soapbox.
No, I agree. And when my book comes out, there will be somebody who's highly pushing nutrient density. I actually start, I know I'm talking about my book again. That's because I'm excited it's about done. When I start my chapter on sort of diet problems that contribute to autoimmune disease, I start it with micronutrient deficiencies. I don't start it with leaky gut. I don't start it with immune enhancing elements and foods. I start it with micronutrient deficiencies because I really believe that as actually the most important part.
Awesome. Well, I love that both of our books are focused on this because even though I'm not a scientist, like it was just really important for me, not just from a nutrient density perspective, but it's also good for the earth and the environment and all that stuff. Like it's good for you. It's good for the animal. It's good for the earth.
Good for your pocketbook. Yeah.
Good for your pocketbook. Like do it. So Sarah and I, we promise both of our books, when they come out, they will help you take this nutrient dense approach. Until then, there is information available on the internet and it will help you heal your gut if you focus on that. Do we even have any other questions now that we've just, that has to have answered them all, right?
Well, it actually will go a long ways towards answering them all, but there is places to go from here. So why don't I start with the
kidding.
Next question?
Of course. Let's answer more questions.
Heather from Hamilton, Ohio, who is very ill with SIBO. She writes, I was shopping in November and had an allergic reaction to a clothing that I tried on. I then had a cascade of systemic malfunction. I lost almost 40 pounds. I became unable to work or live on my own. I was hospitalized with failure to thrive and given TPN. No MD could solve my many medical conditions. I made an appointment at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I'm just checking.
I'm guessing. I'm pretty sure.
Within 2 weeks, I was diagnosed with SIBO. I was treated with 2 rounds of antibiotics. The MD do not want to continue treatment with antibiotics. After 5 weeks, I was released and came home to recuperate with my parents. I have seen a gastro MD, and he told me he had not heard of a diet for SIBO. I asked for a referral to a nutritionalist. She had no idea what SIBO was, and she had been teaching nutrition for 20 years. I have been recuperating for 6 weeks. I still cannot live on my own. I am so malnourished, I cannot complete a sentence. Currently, I am on my 3rd round of antibiotics. How do I find someone to help me? I have had no luck in Tennessee, Ohio, and little nutritional info from the Great Mayo. Where do I turn to next? Someone please give me direction.
Wow, I'm just, my heart's really going out for her.
Yeah. I read that question without crying, though.
Good job.
Because I did cry when I first read it. It appeared in our queue. And I've actually replied to her, but I thought we should discuss this for anybody who might be going through anything similar or even, a less dramatic version of this who still need help.
Well, I would say from my personal perspective, and I've actually heard other people in the community that I respect say this too, there is a time and a place for antibiotics, and I think it's important that she's getting healthy with this because sometimes food alone cannot solve problems. And so I really hope that this helps her rather than hinders her. I would add to the big soapbox spiel that I just had a minute ago, in this case, I would really ask her to focus on some probiotic foods, I've heard that can be incompatible with SIBO because it's fermented and it can eat on that bacteria. So I'll be interested to hear your approach to that, but I'm sure that there are certain probiotic, either supplements or foods that she can take to help, with the rebalancing of her gut bacteria in a healthy way because the antibiotics are flushing everything out. And so you want to make sure that as soon as you come off of antibiotics that you're putting good bacteria back into your gut because there's nothing at all in there after it's flushed. So what you got on this toughie?
Troubleshooting from chapter 9. So I would definitely, yes. I mean, I definitely think that there are times where SIBO is severe enough that you need to do the antibiotic therapies. I would definitely be combining this with a very nutrient-dense and gut-friendly diet like what we talked about for question one. So, I mean, I think we gave lots of sort of options there already. One of the things is, I mean, she didn't mention what antibiotics she's on, but there are a variety of options. Now, the type of antibiotics that are used to treat SIBO are called non-absorbable antibiotics. These are basically ones where a very, very small amount of the antibiotic actually gets into the bloodstream, you know, something like 5%. So they're not really great for treating systemic infections. But what happens is those antibiotics stay in the gut and then kill what's living in it. And definitely they kill the good bacteria along with the bad, but that's kind of like the price you pay for getting rid of so much bad bacteria all at once. So the drug that has been the best studied, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but it's rifaximin. I'm probably not pronouncing that right. And the brand name of rifaximin is Xifaxan. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right either.
This is a problem with reading everything on the internet.
I know. It's X-I-F-A-X-A-N. And that's the one that has been the best studied. But there have been case reports of cases of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth where they've had to combine two or three different kinds of antibiotics in order to keep it down, or sometimes even combine antibiotics with antifungals. So some of the other antibiotics that are that have been well studied and shown to be fairly effective with treating SIBO are vancomycin, neomycin, tetracycline, metronidazole. That's actually an antiparasitical, but it's like an antimicrobial. It kills everything. Levaquin and fluconazole, which is used for yeast infections. So there have been some cases where a combination of those drugs has been really helpful. So that's something to work with her doctor on. Clinical trials where they've combined antibiotic therapy with probiotics and or prebiotics have shown even better outcomes. So they've shown even better effect at resolving the SIBO if probiotics and prebiotics are included. The typical probiotic that's used in these studies is VSL3. But there's also some really good studies using Prescript Assist, which is soil-based organisms, not in this type of situation, but in irritable bowel disease or irritable bowel syndrome, which is would certainly have some similarities since something like 80% of people with irritable bowel syndrome actually have SIBO. And Prescript Assist is one that I've been taking, for like 9 or 10 months, I mean, since last summer, and have had really tremendous success with. So, in fact, I'm pretty sure the reason why I haven't had an autoimmune flare with all of this stress that I'm under right now is because of this probiotic. Again, it's called Prescript Assist, and I love it. And Chris Kresser loves it too, and I heard Chris Kresser. So those are sort of options to talk about with your doctor. I don't know what doses, I don't know when, I don't know what combinations. That is totally beyond my knowledge base. There are also a variety of botanical herbs that can be used as antimicrobials. Some people use them instead of antibiotic therapy. Some people use them in conjunction with. Some people use them afterward. This is, again, not my area of expertise. I sort of know of them, but I don't know what the risks are associated with them. I don't know what the, why you would pick one over the other or what kind of cocktails someone might make for you. So this is a time to definitely be working with a functional medicine specialist. But I'll list some of them just to give you a starting place so that you can bring this list to a doctor and talk about them with a doctor before going on them. I definitely, please do not just go and take these, anybody who's listening to this, because I am not a qualified medical professional to be
you know, giving you like a list of supplements that you then just go, you know, these are all things that you can get relatively easily. Please don't take them without talking to a medical professional who knows you and knows your medical history. Lactoferrin, barberry, Oregon grape, monolaurin, oregano oil, golden seal. I will add a caution for golden seal that it is an immune stimulator, so it's not appropriate for people with autoimmune disease. Olive leaf extract, cat's claw, and wormwood. In addition, there are some supplements that can be used to help speed repair of the gut. I've already talked about omega-3 fatty acids. I've already talked about probiotics. You can also take L-glutamine. That has been shown to help restore the integrity of the gut barrier. It sort of basically fixes the leaks. And DGL, which is a processed form of licorice root that has licorice root on its own has an immune stimulator in it. DGL is a supplement that has the immune stimulator removed. It comes as chewables and lozenges, but those usually have like other problematic ingredients in them, like sugar alcohols and whatever. I would look for a capsule that doesn't have anything else in it. Other things that will be very helpful because SIBO causes micronutrient deficiencies. So beyond going for a really micronutrient dense diet, B vitamins tend to be especially depleted because all of those bacteria growing in your gut eat them. So a B complex type, just watch out because you need to make sure that it says gluten-free on the bottle. Because a lot of B vitamins will contain gluten because of the way that they're manufactured. A B vitamin complex may be a good idea. And then we actually didn't talk about this in the first question, but that was adding digestive support supplements. So there's sort of three groups of digestive support supplements. There's hydrochloric acid, which supports low stomach acid. There are a variety of medical conditions in which that is not appropriate to take. So that includes clotting disorders, stomach ulcers, a variety of types of infections, if you're taking NSAIDs. So that's definitely something to double check with a doctor, whether or not that's appropriate for you to take before you just go take it. The two other classes of supplements are ox bile, which basically helps support your gallbladder function, and it helps emulsify the fats in your diet so that they can be better digested and absorbed, and digestive enzymes, which basically supports pancreatic function because it gives the pancreatic enzymes that would normally be secreted. Those are both much safer to take than hydrochloric acid is. That sounds really obvious when you say it that way, but when you're just looking at the supplement bottles, it's not always that obvious. And those will actually help you get more out of the good food that you're eating, which will hopefully fix micronutrient deficiencies more quickly. Where to look for help: paleophysiciansnetwork.com and primaldocs.com.
Good luck.
Yeah. I'm tired after that one.
Understood.
All right.
We got more, right?
One more. We can do it. Oh, and if people thought that we were like so not going to have serious answers from our first Chit Chatty part of the show, dude, we got answers.
See, we just had to balance it out.
Yeah, that's right. We give you like the 50-50 treatment. All right. So our last question is from Dana from Grand Island. What's N-E?
Nebraska, maybe?
Oh, yeah, Nebraska.
Oh, my God. This is so embarrassing.
At least you're supposed to know. I can plead Canadian.
I wasn't saying you should be embarrassed. I said this is embarrassing.
Yes, well, yeah. All right, I'll just keep reading the question, and you can blush in private. I am recovering from thyroid cancer and have struggled with adrenal fatigue, systematic inflammation, and nutrient malabsorption. Along with taking various minerals, magnesium, glycinate, iron, etc., I take glutamine, enzymes, betaine, which is hydrochloric acid, which we just talked about, and lots of bone broth. I was doing very well on the autoimmune protocol, losing weight, gaining energy, losing fog, and gaining strength. But I started to have stomach pain and digestive issues. In regard to the digestive issues and stomach pain, it doesn't seem to matter if I do or do not take enzymes or betaine. Then I had an adrenal crash. I thought I might have SIBO, but my doctor tested me for H. pylori antibodies, and I tested positive. The next step is a stool test to see if the infection is active. I have enough experience to know that what conventional medicine says about treatment of certain conditions is not always the best. In this case, I've read that you take antibiotics and acid reducers, GAC, and you're healed. What is your take on treatment of H. pylori? I don't know if I have an active infection, but if I do, I want to be prepared to have an intelligent conversation about treatment with my doctor. As a follow-up, if the infection is not active, should I still be doing things to treat it beyond what I do for a leaky gut?
I'm going to let you have this. I don't think I have anything more to add to this conversation.
Okay.
You want me to tackle it?
I'll just have a sip of water before I get going on this one.
I would have the same answers, and I'm not sure that I have anything to add, so.
Okay, so what I will say is that the standard treatment for H. pylori is basically the same drugs as the standard treatment for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So we've already talked about that. And basically the same herbal supplements that can be used for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth can be used for H. pylori. If she wants to go an herbal route under the supervision of a qualified professional. Helicobacter pylori is a gram-negative bacteria that lives in the upper gastrointestinal tract. And it's actually in 50% of the world's population. I mean, it's a larger percentage in people in developing countries. But, you know, basically at least half of us have it. And 80% of H. pylori infections are actually asymptomatic. When they are symptomatic, the dominant symptom is chronic gastritis, which basically means chronic inflammation of the stomach and the upper part of the small intestine. And that causes a lot of symptoms that, can be misleading when we're trying to address our health. But indigestion is sort of the dominant one, but it can cause stomach pain, nausea, bloating, belching. In really severe cases, it can cause vomiting and black stool. Black stool is actually black because of blood in the stool. H. pylori is the bacteria that is the culprit behind stomach ulcers. You know, in the olden days, they used to think it was stress, and then it was one of those big, big discoveries when they realized that stomach ulcers were actually caused by this bacteria. And if you have an H. pylori infection, that dramatically increases your risk of stomach cancer. H. pylori is a pretty interesting little bacteria because if you get infection with H. pylori early in life, it can actually protect you from a variety of immune-related conditions. If you get it later in life, it can actually cause a bunch of immune-related conditions because it actually interacts directly with the immune system. So remember me saying in Science with Sarah that there are cells whose job it is to sort of sample the environment inside the gut. What happens when those cells, they're called dendritic cells, eat, they're eater cells, they eat bad things, an H. pylori, is that the H. pylori can actually interact with a receptor in the cell membrane that affects the types of chemicals, signals that dendritic cell produces. So in a normal situation, a dendritic cell would be like, hey, pathogen, it would eat it. It would go, oh, this is a bad thing. And it would send all these chemical signals to the rest of the immune system to call in reinforcements. The H. pylori is a very tricky little guy. He can actually determine which type of chemical signals that dendrite sends and can even flip back and forth between the different kinds of signals. And in that way, that it's one of the major contributors actually to autoimmune diseases is H. pylori infections, because this bacteria is so good at sort of flipping these switches and controlling, making one part of the immune system dominant that should not be dominant. So, basically, the same types of treatments are available. One of the best treatments is a nutrient-rich diet, which we've already talked about a whole lot this episode. And, of course, she's already mentioned that she's taking digestive support supplements. Conventional treatment is these non-absorbable antibiotics with acid reducers. H. pylori actually already reduces stomach acid, and that's one of the major causes of all the symptoms, is that it massively inhibits digestion and then can lead to SIBO and all these other problems. It's becoming very, very common in the alternative healthcare to actually increase like stomach acid support, or if there's a stomach ulcer concern, then instead to increase through digestive enzymes and ox bile. But there's more of a tendency to support digestion while going through these treatments for H. pylori rather than to further hinder digestion, which I think anybody who knows us think would probably not be surprised that we would say not a good idea. Some of the foods that have been studied in the context of H. pylori, I mean, this basically amounts to supporting the immune system so the immune system can handle it. But these foods are foods that are rich in polyphenols. So those are, you know, vegetables, really, really high pigmented fruits like berries, cranberry juice, green tea, extra virgin olive oil, coconut oil, cruciferous vegetables. Those are things like broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, have a variety of substances in them that have been shown to kill H. pylori. Vitamin C has been shown to be really beneficial in H. pylori infections. And Manuka honey, which I haven't tried. I don't know. Have you ever tried Manuka honey? I've heard it's a really good antimicrobial, but it's actually been shown to be good against H. pylori infections.
It's just really expensive.
Yeah, I've heard that's why I haven't tried it.
Yeah, I went to the store with the intention of purchasing it, knowing that it was expensive, and I like saw how expensive ended up not purchasing it.
That's great. I will try something else.
So I focus on just local raw honey, and we don't need a lot of honey. I mean, if I were actively like putting it in my tea,
yeah,
or
I think this
whatever.
Is more Manuka honey is more of like a supplement honey rather than a like spread on your. I don't know what you spread honey on anymore.
Yeah,
spread on your slices of apple. I don't know.
But that's what I mean. Like, I don't know how to eat it other than in ways that would potentially kill
whatever was good in it.
Yeah. Maybe on like some, we both have paleo bread recipes. Like you could, I'm sure, make kids a almond butter and honey.
That is one of my kids' favorites, and we make bread so infrequently now.
With
so when
bananas,
I do hope,
yeah.
It's like almond butter and honey sandwich, like town, and it's and everyone goes crazy and happy. But
back on track. Sorry to distract
yeah,
you.
Yeah, let's just back up because even though almond flour-based bread is a great food for people who are really missing bread and need that to feel happy in their lives, it's probably not the most nutrient-dense food you could be eating if you have an active H. pylori infection. So do you need to treat it? It really depends on how severe your symptoms are. I would ask your doctor what they think. You know, given that there's a history of other immune-related issues,
given, I don't know, she said she had thyroid cancer. I don't know if she had her thyroid removed or not. So that sort of complicates things if you're supplementing with thyroid hormone, adrenal fatigue. Those are all things that are going to suppress the immune system. And so basically, you know, this H. pylori may be, you know, you might have had it for decades, but it's basically growing now and it's reproducing and it's causing problems because your immune system is just not working very well. So doing the autoimmune protocol, we've already talked about nutrient density to help support the immune system, is a great place to start if your doctor feels that trying a natural treatment is appropriate for you. I mean, if symptoms are really bad, you know, there is a time and place for conventional medicine. So, so those are sort of, those are discussions to have with your doctor. I think this episode has probably been the kind that people will listen to with a notepad and a pen and probably write a ton of stuff down. Good thing we have Monica for show notes.
Good
thing.
Don't
just write it down. Go to the show notes, print them off, and you're set. Bring those to your doctor and you'll be good. You know, yes, it is possible to just basically support the immune system and add all of these really antioxidant rich, antimicrobial rich foods and try and just boost your immune system without using immune stimulators. If you have a history of autoimmune disease, stay away from immune stimulating herbals. But these are more herbals that sort of support the natural function of the immune system. And vitamins, you know, minerals. And you can see how far that gets you, if your doctor's willing to give it some time. But those are really, again, going to have to be discussions that are done in your doctor's office. So, as much as it can be intimidating to look at conventional medicine treatments when we are so used to fighting all of those ideas in the paleo community, there are times where it is the best course of action.
Agreed.
Phew.
We made it.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like now I kind of am happy that we balanced the front with a little bit of happy, but at the same time, people are going to refer to their friends to this episode for like, go check out this serious stuff. And they'll get through the first 20 minutes and be like, what serious stuff?
Well, you know.
Oh, well. That's why
we're multifaceted people. We enjoy.
I like to balance it out.
Good times.
Cool. Well, because I'm standing at my standing desk, I'm going to wrap this up so that I can go not stand.
Yeah. I don't blame you. And I'm actually really sick and tired of sitting, so I'm going to go and
move. So we're going to swap.
Yeah. Perfect.
Cool. Well, all right. We will be back. Don't forget, if you want to check out the bonus show, leave reviews, and we'll be back next week, probably with some slightly dense topic, but nonetheless interesting and helpful.
Excellent. Good night, everybody. Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
My computer is exploding right now.